But there's also a more specific, even we may say a more concrete approach to Buddhism. That is to say, an approach to it in terms of conditions here and now, in this country, in the midst of this 20th century. And that brings us, of course, to the subject of today's talk, which is Buddhism in England. Now, the question may be put as to why, as part of a series introducing Buddhism, we have to consider, or should pause to consider, this question of Buddhism in England at all. Some people might remark, well, why not get straight on with the exposition of Buddhism? Why not get straight on to the philosophical first principles? Why not get on to the spiritual and ethical path? Why, as it were, pause to consider something apparently irrelevant, even though of interest, like Buddhism in England? Why not get straight on, as I've said, with the exposition of the Dharma, of the Buddha's teaching itself? Now, the question isn't really so simple. The position isn't really so straightforward as all that. As I'm sure you've all gathered by this time, we're concerned with Buddhism, especially here in this Vihara, we're concerned with Buddhism, not just theoretically, not just as a subject of study, but practically. Not just as a matter of intellectual research and investigation, but as a matter above all else of the actual spiritual life. Now we know, if we've tried, that it's very, very difficult indeed to lead a spiritual life, whether as a Buddhist, or as a Christian, or as a Muslim, or as a Hindu, or as the follower of any other faith, in complete isolation from other people who are following that same path. Last week, I think it was, we referred to the case of those people, quite a number of them, perhaps even quite a few hundred of them, scattered up and down this country, who, though Buddhists, have no contact with any other Buddhists, who are quite isolated, quite cut off. And it does seem, from what we've heard of them, from what they've told us, that they do have a quite difficult time. And that's why most of them do look forward so very much to occasional trips to London, where they can meet other Buddhists, or else visits to Biddulph for meditation, or else once a year, perhaps, a sojourn at the Buddhist Society's summer school. And they look forward to it so much because to struggle, to strive, to lead a spiritual life by oneself, just with the help of books, with no one to talk to, no one whose advice one can ask, no one on whom one can rely and depend, no one to whom one can turn in difficulties, at least for a little encouragement, a little inspiration, if not a little guidance, is very, very difficult indeed. Aristotle says somewhere that if a man can endure to live alone, well, he's either a beast or a god. So most people, as he himself goes on to say, are neither beasts nor gods. They're somewhere in between. So they can't stay alone. They need society, they need company, they need companions, they need friends. And in the spiritual life, even more so perhaps than in the secular, the ordinary social life. So for most people, we do find that the spiritual life is best, certainly most easily led as a member of a spiritual group. One may not even be in contact with anyone very highly advanced spiritually, but at least if one is in contact with a group, that is with other people following the same spiritual path as oneself is following, then at least there is mutual encouragement and mutual stimulation. I remember in this connection, it just comes to me as I happen to be speaking about this, that when I took up myself the monastic life, I found it very, very helpful indeed, inasmuch as there were two of us together. I was ordained as a samanera, as a novice, at the same time as my friend who is now in charge of an important vihara in Bangalore, that is Bhikkhu Buddharakita. We both became samaneras together at Kusinagara, at the hands of a well-known Burmese Mahathera. After that we set out on our travels together. We stayed together in various ashrams and various hermitages, sometimes in mountain caves. So it was very encouraging sometimes that if one flagged a little, then the other was there to stimulate. If one, say, wants you to get up late, well, the other was there to say, no, we must get up early this morning and meditate, and so on. Or if one was studying and didn't quite understand what he was reading, well, there was the other one to ask, to discuss with, to consult. So one does find this sort of thing very, very useful, very, very helpful indeed. So not only in the monastic life, but even in the case of our spiritual life as lay Buddhists, we get a great deal of encouragement, or we can get, should get, a great deal of encouragement and stimulation from our fellow Buddhists, those who are following the same path, those who are aspiring to the realization of the same spiritual ideals. We find as Buddhists that our spiritual lives are not lived in isolation. As Dunn says, no man is an island entire unto himself. We're all linked, as it were, underground or undersea, as it were, to the continent, to the larger life, the life of the group. So our spiritual lives as Buddhists are part of the larger spiritual life of the group to which we may belong. Now this particular group, in our cases, may either be this vihara, the Hampstead Buddhist Vihara, it may be the Buddhist Society, or it may be some little provincial group in Birmingham or at Oxford or in some other part of the country. Ultimately, of course, it is what we may call the whole Buddhist or whole English Buddhist movement in this country. This ultimately is the larger spiritual group to which we all belong. So we can't really separate ourselves from it. If we want to lead a spiritual life as Buddhists in the fullest possible sense, that we can. And the majority of English Buddhists, of course, in any case, don't want to separate themselves from that larger spiritual life of the group to which they belong, because they find it so very helpful. At the same time, there should be a word of warning, or at least of caution here. That is to say, we shouldn't use the Buddhist group as what we may call a symbiotic community substitute. Now, what do we mean by that? Suppose someone's rather lonely. They just live round the corner somewhere, all on their own. Don't go to church, of course. Don't belong to a club. Perhaps it's too expensive. Don't like sports or games. Don't even like chess. But they come to learn that there's a nice little organization near at hand. Nice people meet there every Sunday afternoon, sometimes during the week. So it's quite pleasant to go along and have a little company and have a little chat. And if you have to listen to the lecture also, well, that's perhaps a little price which no one might pay for the sake of the social amenities. So in this way, the Buddhist group comes to be used, it may so happen, as a sort of community substitute. One doesn't belong to a real community, either because one lives in some little flat miles away from one's place of business, one has no relations, no friends, no sort of social group to belong to. So one starts using the Buddhist group in this way. So up to a point, of course, this is in a sense legitimate, but to use it altogether as a sort of substitute in this way isn't quite what one has in mind. We'll come back to this topic perhaps a little later on. If the Buddhist group is properly used, of course, it provides us with what we may describe as the immediate context of our spiritual life. Now, as already has been made clear, I hope, in this series, there's no spiritual life without self-awareness. You can have, of course, some sort of conventional religious life without self-awareness, But you can't have any really meaningful, progressing, constantly progressing spiritual life without self-awareness. In a sense, one might even say that the whole spiritual life is simply a process of progressive intensification of one's self-awareness. So that out of the very intensity of one's self-awareness, as we saw a little while ago, I think it was last week, we reach a state of awareness, as it were, of non-self or non-self-awareness. However, we're not concerned with that this afternoon. Now, I've said that our spiritual life is bound up with that of the spiritual group or spiritual community to which we belong. Or putting it in Buddhist terminology, which may be more comprehensible to some of you, going for refuge, as we call it, Sharanagamana, is an essential and intrinsic part of being a Buddhist itself. You can't be a Buddhist and go for refuge to the Buddha, go for refuge to the Dharma, and not go for refuge to the Sangha. Going for refuge to the Sangha, therefore, is an intrinsic part, part of the very definition, as it were, of one's being a Buddhist. Now, spiritual self-awareness should include, therefore, awareness of ourselves as members of the group to which we belong. If we're not aware of ourselves as members of the spiritual group to which we belong, then we're not really fully aware of ourselves. Because the fact of our membership of the group is part of the very definition of ourselves. So in this case, it means the whole Buddhist movement in England. In other words, we can't be really and truly spiritually self-aware of ourselves unless we're at the same time aware of the movement to which we belong, of which we are members, and of which, in fact, we are a part. Now, if we understand this, if we understand this movement, this Buddhist movement in England, understand something of its history, its significance, its possible or probable destination, then we shall understand all the better what we, as individual Buddhists, are, what we're trying to do, what we're trying to accomplish. So that's why we find it necessary to include in this particular series of talks introducing Buddhism, one on Buddhism in England.